Chapter 10. The Essence of Keto. For those who fatten easily, a way of eating that restricts an entire food group, an LCHF ketogenic dietary pattern, may be necessary and ideal. Robert Atkins earned his infamy as a diet doctor in part because his book was selling so well, while promoting the idea of eating large amounts of fat and particularly saturated fats. The establishment medical doctors and nutritionists may have been more than a little envious of the former. They were sincerely worried about the latter. They feared that Atkins was killing people and conning them in the process. They didn't trust in the least a concept that Atkins was the first of the diet book doctors to fully embrace: ketogenesis and the role of ketone bodies, less technically and for our purposes, ketones, and ketosis in a weight loss diet. This was what the AMA-sponsored critique was referring to specifically as a bizarre nutritional concept. It was a radical notion then, and it still worries establishment physicians and dietitians. The idea that avoiding carbohydrate-rich foods was a good strategy if you didn't want to be fat had been around at least since Jean-Alphonse Savarin in the 1820s. It had become, as I've noted, common thinking. Every woman knew carbohydrates were fattening. Atkins took it one step further and suggested first that the carbohydrates should be replaced by fat, and not just any fat, but saturated fat-rich foods, lobster with butter sauce, steak with béarnaise sauce. He then evoked the concept of ketones and ketosis, what is now called nutritional ketosis, aka keto, as a way to establish whether the diet was actually working, getting fat out of your fat cells and then used for fuel and so out of your body. Ketones are molecules that are synthesized in liver cells when those cells are burning fat for fuel. They are created from the byproducts of this fat burning, oxidation, either from the fat in your diet or from the fat you store when insulin is low enough that the fat is mobilized. Unlike the fat from which they're made, ketones can readily cross the blood-brain barrier, and the brain can and will use them for fuel when carbohydrates are in short supply. That the brain and heart reportedly run more efficiently on ketones than on glucose suggests they may be an ideal fuel for the human body. Footnote: authorities like to say that glucose, blood sugar, is your brain's preferred fuel. But that, again, is because your brain burns glucose for fuel when you're eating a carb-rich diet. It's conceivable that our bodies decided, figuratively speaking, that since our brains use up so much of the energy we generate, around 20%, having our brains burn glucose would be necessary to control blood sugar in a high-carb world, even if ketones were somehow a better source, like a higher-octane fuel for your car. Ketosis is what's happening when your liver is synthesizing more than a minimal amount of ketones. For Atkins, ketones and ketosis were his patent claim, to use Gladwell's phrase, that set his diet apart from the every woman knows conventional wisdom. Rather than merely noting that carbohydrates are fattening and the diets that restrict them but not calories, hence replacing the carbohydrate calories with fat, seem to be a biologically appropriate means to reduce excess weight, he couched his eating plan as a revolutionary diet. As we've discussed, this is a common approach of doctors who write diet books, and it has served to complicate simple science, while also offering up a world of speculation that may or may not work to our benefit. In Atkins's case, he wasn't merely claiming his diet fixed a problem by removing a principal cause, which it does. He was providing a unique therapy that could be understood only by reading his book and following his instructions. Those instructions included moving through dietary stages with progressively higher carbohydrate contents if they could be tolerated. The induction phase of the Atkins diet removes all carbohydrates other than those stored as glycogen in meat and the minimal carbohydrates in green vegetables. Most green vegetables fall into the category that nutritionists used to call 5% vegetables, which means only 5% of their weight comes from carbohydrates that we can digest, and the rest is mostly water and some roughage, which we now call fiber, and which we barely digest to make use of for fuel. A cup of broccoli, for instance, has maybe 4 grams of digestible carbohydrates, 16 calories worth. And those carbohydrates are slow to digest and absorb, hence minimizing their effect on blood sugar and insulin. This makes the green vegetables benign from an endocrine perspective, while beneficial from the nutritional point of view. If the green vegetables were eaten along with fatty meats and sauces, that made them more benign still. Whether Atkins knew it or not, this combination of fatty meat, fats, and green vegetables would come close to most efficiently keeping insulin levels low and prolonging the amount of time that fat would be mobilized from the fat cells and oxidized for fuel, and ketones would be generated. As weight was lost, Atkins counseled, dieters could choose to slowly add back minimal carbohydrates they might miss, so long as their liver continued to churn out ketones, that is, as long as they remained in ketosis. Atkins called the point at which they stopped generating detectable levels of ketones the critical carbohydrate level, and the point of his diet was to remain under that threshold. That would be checked by using what are called ketone strips, which can be purchased at pharmacies where they are sold for diabetics, for whom avoiding one particularly severe form of ketosis, known as diabetic ketoacidosis, is critically important to staying alive. Indeed, ketones were first observed in the mid-19th century in the urine of diabetics who were dying from their disease. This is why the medical community has typically seen ketones as signs that something terrible is occurring, as pathological agents ever since. It's the wrong interpretation, and again, overly simplistic thinking, but you can imagine the problem. As I said, establishment physicians still worry about ketones and ketosis, but that's because they don't always read the literature carefully. Steve Finney of the University of California at Davis and Jeff Volek of Ohio State University are two of the handful of researchers who have actually studied the physiology of ketosis in the laboratory and in clinical trials, and so have contributed significantly to our understanding of these molecules and this physiological state. As they have written, ketones are now linked to a broad spectrum of health benefits. They are anything but pathological, at least when the body is working correctly. To understand ketosis and ketogenic diets, keto, you must understand that several conditions must be fulfilled for your liver to synthesize detectable levels of ketones. It has to be burning fat at a high rate, which means insulin levels have to be very low, and that means carbohydrates have to be at least mostly absent from the diet and blood sugar levels have to be at a healthy minimum. One of the many things insulin does is shut down your liver's synthesis of ketones. Again, this makes engineering sense. Insulin in the circulation is a sign that blood sugar is elevated and that cells had better be vigorously metabolizing that glucose, either burning it for energy, storing it as glycogen, or making fat out of it. Ketones, like the fat in our diet, would be neither necessary nor desirable fuel sources during what should ideally be only post-meal periods. As blood sugar drops, though, and the insulin in the circulation also drops, as it should if you're healthy, fat is mobilized from fat tissue and the liver cells burn that fat. Now, the liver's ketone body synthesis goes from idling in the background, as Finney and Volek describe it, to generating ketones that can replace glucose as fuel for the brain. Now, the body is in nutritional ketosis. This is a term coined by Finney to distinguish it clearly from the pathological state of ketoacidosis, when the body lacks all insulin, while perhaps simultaneously distancing it from the aroma of quackery that has always been attached to Atkins for the crime of being a flamboyant and financially successful pioneer in this unconventional dietary thinking. Ketones are measured in units of millimoles per liter. On a typical carbohydrate-rich diet, your ketone level is likely to be about 0.1 millimoles per liter, which is the product of the liver's ketone body synthesis machinery idling in the background state. If you go 12 hours without eating, which you'll often do in your life, from finishing dinner at 7 p.m., say, to having breakfast at a reasonable hour the next morning, your pre-breakfast ketone body levels will have tripled, up to 0.3 millimoles per liter, as your insulin is low and your liver is synthesizing ketones to help feed your brain, if nothing else. Continue to fast for more than several days, and you'll be at 5 to 10 millimoles per liter. Footnote. Among the key observations in the early 1960s that apparently led Atkins to think of a ketogenic diet as healthy was the fact that our bodies don't distinguish between fuel that is stored and fuel that we've just eaten. Cells will metabolize the protein and fat from either source with no way to know the difference. As such, when our ancestors fasted or had to live through famines, they metabolized primarily or exclusively fat and protein for fuel. The same is true during nutritional ketosis, suggesting that it's a relatively natural or at least benign state, not something to be feared. This had also led Eric Westman at Duke to suggest that rather than say, you are what you eat, nutritionists and dietitians should counsel patients and clients to eat what you are, that is, fat and protein. On an Atkins diet, aka nutritional ketosis, your ketones might be as high as 2 or 3 millimoles per liter. After exercise on the same diet, when insulin is very low, you might even hit 5 millimoles per liter. All relatively low numbers compared to those in diabetic ketoacidosis, the state that so justifiably worries physicians and diabetes specialists. In diabetic ketoacidosis, fat cells dump their stored fat into the circulation, the liver wildly synthesizes ketones, and carbohydrates are not being taken up and used for fuel at anything like the rate that's necessary. Meanwhile, the liver is also generating glucose to use for more fuel. All these fuels are accumulating in the bloodstream, and pathological metabolic hell is clearly breaking out. Ketone body levels in diabetic ketoacidosis are typically well over 20 millimoles per liter. This is a condition to be rightly feared, but it is an entirely different physiological state than nutritional ketosis. As I've said repeatedly, physicians, and even the expert physicians in this field, are prone to overly simplistic thinking, particularly when they are worried that harm will be done. Footnote. Worth noting is that ketones themselves stimulate some insulin secretion, and the insulin secretion in turn inhibits ketone synthesis. This is a naturally occurring negative feedback loop that prevents ketone levels from getting pathologically high merely from changing our diets. For our purpose, ketones and nutritional ketosis can be thought of as signs, as biological markers, that fat is being mobilized and burned for fuel rather than stored. Ideally, that would mean you're becoming leaner, the goal, after all, of a weight loss diet. If the goal is to burn fat without hunger, then nutritional ketosis is a good thing. Is such a drastic approach wise? That question has driven a half century of controversy over these diets. Surely a way of eating that doesn't restrict an entire food category and doesn't make your breath smell like acetone from the ketones, which it can, could work as well in reducing excess fat, would be easier to sustain for a lifetime and healthier to boot. Surely that would represent less risk with equal benefit and greater sustainability, wouldn't it? The short answer is that it almost assuredly depends on the individual. For the long answer, we have to return to insulin and the statement from the AMA-endorsed denunciation of Atkins: fat is mobilized when insulin secretion diminishes. This is simple enough, although Yallo and Burson phrased it more precisely when they wrote that the necessary requirement for mobilizing fat from fat cells was the negative stimulus of insulin deficiency. Now, let's go back to human physiology, metabolism, and endocrinology. As it turns out, this negative stimulus of insulin deficiency concept comes with two critical caveats. Yallo and Burson were aware of both, but they weren't thinking at the time in terms of the implications for a successful weight loss diet, let alone writing diet books. The establishment authorities typically paid little attention, perceiving it as not relevant to their gluttony and sloth thinking. First, we all respond to carbohydrates differently. Enormous variation exists from person to person. That's one very good reason why, given the same foods to eat, some of us will grow up to be built like fashion models, and some of us will be extremely obese. Moreover, different cells and tissues, even in the same individual, respond differently to insulin. Here, too, there's enormous variation. When tissues and cells become resistant to insulin, they do so at different rates and different levels of insulin in the circulation. For this reason, as Burson and Yallo cautioned, it is desirable, wherever possible, to distinguish generalized resistance of all tissues from resistance of only individual tissues. If a physician were to diagnose you as insulin resistant, which is likely if you're fattening easily, that physician would have little, if any, awareness of how that insulin resistance differed between tissues, whether your fat cells, for instance, continued to respond to insulin even while the other cells in your body had ceased paying attention to the hormone. Whatever is happening with insulin elsewhere in your body, the fact is that as long as your fat cells do remain insulin sensitive and insulin is secreted, your fat cells will be storing fat and your body will be accumulating fat. In other words, as Yallo and Burson pointed out, if you're actually getting fatter, your fat cells must be responding to insulin regardless of what is happening elsewhere in your body. Your fat cells must still be insulin sensitive. It seems to be a precondition of the fattening process. This leads to the second critical caveat, the regrettable one. Fat cells, in particular, tend to be exquisitely sensitive to insulin. Some variation on this phrase came to be used commonly by researchers when they described this phenomenon even in their academic articles. I heard it repeatedly in my interviews of those researchers who made the effort to study fat metabolism. It means that fat cells sense and respond to the presence of insulin in the circulation at levels so low that other cells and tissues don't even know it's there. And fat cells continue to respond to insulin long after those other cells and tissues become resistant. Elevating insulin even slightly above some hypothetical threshold will cause fat cells to enter storage mode. The longer the insulin remains elevated, even if by barely measurable amounts, the longer fat cells will be storing fat, not mobilizing it. For this reason, some of the most prominent diabetes researchers in the world, i.e., the specialists whose purview included paying attention to insulin, had speculated in the 1960s and 70s, that having too much insulin circulating in the blood or having fat tissue excessively sensitive to insulin might be the cause of obesity. It might be the reason, as Brooke said, the metabolism shifts too much into storage mode, the reason some of us may trap 5 or 10 or 20 or even 100 excess calories a day as fat into our fat tissue, and others don't. These researchers were just speculating on what seemed like an obvious cause and effect possibility, a prime suspect in the mechanism of why we get fat. In the early 1990s, a team of researchers at the University of Texas, San Antonio, methodically measured what being exquisitely sensitive to insulin means. In doing so, they identified a threshold level of insulin in the circulation below which fat cells and fat metabolism act entirely differently than they do when insulin is above that threshold. The head of the research team was Ralph DeFronzo, who had pioneered the technology necessary to make this measurement in humans. DeFronzo and his colleagues may have been the only ones in the world capable at the time of making this measurement. As they reported, the exquisite sensitivity of fat cells to insulin was their most striking finding. And, with my apologies, please refer to the PDF that comes with this program for the second and last technical diagram. This figure may be the single most important figure in the whole diet, weight loss, obesity discussion. Obesity and fat accumulation, along with their attendant effects on hunger, satiety, and cravings, cannot be understood without understanding the implications of this research. The figure shows how insulin affects the mobilization of fat, technically fatty acids, from our fat cells, and the use of that fat for fuel at different levels of insulin circulating in the bloodstream. Follow the line on the figure from right to left, from high levels of insulin on the right side to very low levels, the negative stimulus of insulin deficiency on the left, at the vertical axis. By doing so, what you're seeing is how the fat cells respond to insulin as the concentration of insulin in the circulation drops toward nothing. The horizontal line from over 200 units of insulin down to about 25 tells us that for most of the range of insulin in the bloodstream, the fat cells remain insulin sensitive and hold on to fat, and the other cells in the body remain averse to using that fat for fuel, oxidizing the fat. Throughout this range, as DeFronzo and his colleagues wrote in their technical language, insulin inhibits lipolysis, the breakdown and release of fat from the fat cells and use of fat for fuel. The amount of fat escaping the fat cells and being used for fuel remains the same throughout this range and relatively low. So above a certain level, whether a little above or very high above, the fat tissue remains sensitive to insulin, and the fat within it remains pretty much locked away, trapped. Other cells do not metabolize fat for fuel. Both fat cells and cells in the organs and lean tissues are responding to insulin and acting accordingly. But then there's the threshold, what the arrows I added are pointing to in the figure. When insulin gets sufficiently low, when the negative stimulus of insulin is sufficiently draconian, everything changes. It's like a switch is thrown. Above the threshold, fat cells hold on to fat. Below it, they release their stored fat into the circulation, and the other cells in the body take it up and use it for fuel. Above the threshold, our bodies burn carbohydrates and store fat. Below it, our bodies burn fat. The diet book doctors would say we're fat-burning machines, which is what we want to be if we've got excessive fat stored. And here's the particularly unfortunate caveat. This threshold is very low. In DeFronzo's study, it was very low despite the fact that the subjects were lean, healthy, college-age students. In the technical language of the paper, free fatty acid outflow from the adipose tissue occurs in the low physiological range of insulin concentrations and is exquisitely sensitive to small changes in the plasma insulin level. The threshold is far below what insulin levels would typically be day in and day out in individuals who are obese or predisposed to get that way, in those who fatten easily. It's exceedingly easy to get above the threshold, which means it's exceedingly difficult to get and stay below it. Those who fatten easily and who eat sugars, starches, and grains, will spend most of their days and perhaps too many hours of their nights above the threshold, and precious little time, and certainly not enough, below it. For our purposes, we can think of this threshold of insulin sensitivity in terms of Atkins and his critical carbohydrate threshold. By advising his readers to add back carbohydrates while still checking to see if they were in ketosis, he was essentially telling them to check if their fat tissue, even with the added carbohydrates, remained below this insulin threshold. When we're almost below it, our livers may or may not be synthesizing ketones in large numbers, but we are certainly burning fat for fuel. If we are synthesizing considerable ketones and so are in ketosis, we're certainly below the threshold, and the more time we spend below this threshold, day in and day out, the more time we spend burning fat, and the less fat we're storing. While all of us, lean or fat, must have critical carbohydrate thresholds. The more predisposed we are to put on fat, the easier we fatten, the lower the insulin threshold is likely to be, or the less time, at least, we spend below it. Atkins's approach of adding back carbohydrates and checking ketones made sense, but it also assumed that this threshold wouldn't change with time, which isn't necessarily the case. It also assumed that maintaining weight loss over a lifetime would be more sustainable and more pleasurable with some carb-rich foods, rather than virtually none. This may be true for many people, and maybe even most. It's probably the reason many people seem to achieve and maintain a healthy weight merely by making sure their carbohydrates are fiber-rich, slow to digest and absorb. This keeps insulin relatively low and, if they're maintaining a healthy weight, below the threshold for these lucky people. But another possibility, all too plausible, is that some of us, at least, will find it easier to eat virtually no carbohydrate-rich foods than to try to eat them in moderation, and that this reality is less about willpower than about, once again, human physiology. Even while some of us may continue to lose weight or maintain a healthy weight while eating slow carbs, to use the terminology I first heard from the entrepreneur author Tim Ferriss, we may find those foods in which the carbohydrates are bound up with fiber and are so digested slowly to be a slippery slope best avoided.